Once again, what I had intended to talk about today has kind of been usurped by things that happened during the week. So I kind of changed courses, and I hope you guys can change courses with me without too much blue smoke coming out our ears or anything. To start with, how many of you as kids had those toys, either wooden or plastic, where you had boxes that fit into other boxes that fit into a smaller box and a smaller box and a smaller box? Remember those? And you'd pull each box out and how much fun that was. Or maybe you had those wooden dolls that you would pull apart and inside would be a little bit smaller one and a smaller one and a smaller one. Marion and I went to Carmel several years ago, and there was a Russian store there, and they sold these things. I mean, just hundreds of them, all different sizes and shapes, from this big to small. They call them matryoshkas, which means mother in Russian. Did you know that in every language on earth, the word mother contains that M sound? That's pretty interesting. It has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. I give you that one for free. But that just popped into my brain. This idea of boxes within boxes and dolls within dolls, hang on to that image for a second. Because what I want to try to do is start off somewhere in left field and see if we can get back to this idea of boxes within boxes. Because what happened this week was really pretty much a historic event, and it really is something that I've been following. And it's the visit of Pope Benedict XVI to the United States. And really a historic visit, his first visit here. And I found myself kind of getting glued to the set and watching certain events and aspects of his trip here. I thought it was great that President Bush actually drove out and to pick him up at the airport. That was just classic. But then he did a mass at National Stadium in Washington, D.C. And there was about 46,000 people in attendance. And I'm watching him, and of course the scene is just beautiful. They have a full orchestra and a huge choir and all these things going on. But what struck me, and I grew up Catholic. Anybody else grew up Catholic here? Okay, we've got a few. As I was listening to, I haven't practiced Catholicism for getting close to 18, 20 years, longer I think. But I'm listening to Benedict give the Mass and say the Mass in his broken English, and I realized I remember all the words to the liturgy. It was just coming back to me. And all these memories started flooding in from my days in the church and as a Catholic, and especially even as an altar boy. You know, I was an altar boy, and I remember how exciting that was. You know, I'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, I'd ride my bike to the church, and you'd put on the vestments and get everything ready for a 7 o'clock Mass. And I don't know how your memories work, but some of my memories are just these almost holographic flashes in my mind, you know, kind of a tableau setting. I can still close my eyes and I can see the way the light reflected in the bottom of the golden chalice with the wine. I can see the reflection of the ripples on the priest's face as he spoke. You know, from my vantage point as a child looking up, I can see that. I can smell the incense. I can smell what the wine even smelled like, you know, the sacramental wine. And so all of these kind of images and memories were flooding back as I'm listening to the Pope give this Mass. And I found myself, even though I haven't been a practicing Catholic in such a long time, kind of swelling with pride a little bit, you know. This is my Papa, Il Papa, this is my Pope, you know, and I was connecting again with being Catholic and what that meant as being part of this huge worldwide body. And I thought that was really strange. It was odd to me to have those kind of sensations since I've been out of the church for so long. And then I'm watching people during the Mass who were selected to be received by the Pope, and they're coming up. Many of them were in habits, nuns or lay people, and they were coming up, and the Pope was sitting in his chair, and they'd come up and they'd kiss his ring, and you could just tell by their body language, even from the back, you couldn't see any faces, that this was one of the greatest moments of their lives, to be able to come up and connect with their Holy Father, with the Pope. And you know, it's a comforting thing to have sort of a tangible leader, a tangible focus point, a reference point. And that's kind of what the Pope provides. There's a movie that I saw called The Body several years ago, and I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it's a real interesting movie. If you ever get a chance, check it out. The plot's not important right now, but there was a scene right at the end of the movie that kind of came flooding back as I was watching this scene unfold on the television screen. And in this movie, a Catholic priest is thrown in with a sort of a secular Israeli-Jewish archaeologist. And so the two of them have this adventure together. But at the very end of the movie, when the priest has left and gone back to Rome, he left his crucifix that was on a chain that he always had around his neck. He left it at her house. And her little daughter finds it, who's probably 7 or 8 in the movie. And she says, "Mom, you know, what's this doing here?" And she says, "Oh, that was my friend Matt's." His name was Matt, too. "That was my friend Matt's, and he's a Christian. And so he wears that around his neck just the way you wear your father's Mogen David." And Mogen David literally would be Shield of David. We would call it the Star of David. It's a six-pointed star. And she says, "This is a symbol." And of course, this is a Catholic cross, so there's a corpus on it. There's a body on it. And she says, "Well, who's this on the cross?" And her mother says, "Well, what would you say if I told you that was their God?" And you know what she says? She says, "Wow, they're lucky. They can see their God." And her mother asks you, "Well, do you think it's important that we can't see our God?" And they have this little discussion. You know, there's something to this. There's something to being able to identify with a group that we belong to. There's something to be said for identifying with a leader, someone that we can connect with, someone we can focus on. I mean, all of that energy, it's a very human thing. You know, it's just part of our human nature, part of our DNA, to want that, to want to be able to connect and identify with a group. And I started thinking about how, you know, in this moment, I was longing to reconnect with that group. You know, it's wonderful to have our little group, our non-denominational group. But sometimes, don't you just want to be part of something huge, part of something bigger than yourself? And I think that's what all this is speaking to. And I started thinking about all the groups that we identify ourselves with. Think about all the groups you identify yourself with. I mean, some of you may have the vanity license plates on the back of your cars. And if you do or if you don't, think about what is the thing that you would put on that license plate that defines you, that shows you what the principal group that you identify with is. What is it? You know? Have you got American flags all over your car? Is it nationalism that really defines you and is the group that you connect with? Is it a political party? You know? Are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? Are you a conservative? Are you a liberal? Are you a Knicks fan? Are you a Ducks fan? You know, is that the thing that really defines you? And think about the things that you see on people's license plates. You know, they're salesmen, they're Christians, they're this, they're that. You know, they've got the fish on there, they've got the Darwin fish on there, they've got whatever they've got. But so many of us are focused on the group that we identify with. And sometimes that identification runs so deep that it excludes us from other groups. Or excludes others who are in other groups from being in our group. I once had a pastor that I worked with actually say from the pulpit that he believed that Christians were supposed to love fellow Christians differently and better than those who were not Christians. And that just struck me as so odd. How can we say something like that, knowing what it is that we believe about what Jesus was trying to tell us? And yet sometimes our identification with the group gets that strong that it starts to isolate us from other groups. And then on Thursday, the Pope did something really extraordinary. He went to the Park East Synagogue in New York City. First time that a Pope has ever set foot in a U.S. synagogue. And only about the third time or fourth time that a Pope has visited any synagogue ever. And so you had the Pope, Benedict, his original name is John Ratzinger, who grew up in Germany with Rabbi Schneier, who has been the rabbi at Park East Synagogue for decades and is a world-renowned leader in human rights who also grew up in Germany. And here is the fascinating thing to me as I watch this. You've got the Pope, the leader of the Catholic Church, speaking, reading, prepared statement in English, you know, in his thick accent, and talking about how honored he was to be sharing this time in the synagogue. And then you had the rabbi come up and share same sentiments. But when they turned and spoke to each other, they spoke in German. Because both of them grew up in Germany. the Pope in Bavaria and the rabbi in Vienna. And not only that, both of them suffered greatly during the Nazi years. And the Pope the rabbi was a Holocaust survivor. The Pope was drafted or pressed into the Nazi youth gangs, but he escaped as soon as he could. He had a cousin with Down syndrome who was spirited away by the secret police and euthanized because Jews and anyone who was less than perfect in their eyes were not worthy to live and weren't worthy to carry on that Aryan race. And so here you had boxes within boxes within boxes. The Pope is within his Pope box. The Pope is within his Catholic box. The Pope is within his Christian box. The rabbi is within his Jewish box, within his social justice box. But both of those boxes and all of those boxes were inside the German box, were inside the box of common experiences that the two faced back in the 30s and the 40s as mere children, that have defined them, that have changed their lives. And somehow, even instinctively, they knew that when they were talking to each other, and you could still hear them off mic, to speak in their native tongues, the tongues they grew up with. They connected with each other. Somehow that box transcended all the other boxes that defined them and connected them at a level that transcended all of that. To me, that was an incredible moment. And then after the two of them had exchanged gifts, they had two young kids come up to the podium, a young girl and a young boy. The girl was probably, she looked 14 or 15 to me, and the boy a little bit older. And they were also giving gifts to the Pope. And the girl went first, and the camera angle was looking at their backs over their shoulder and the Pope facing the camera, so you couldn't see the kids' faces. But she gave her gift to the Pope. And then he turned to the boy, but I'm watching this girl, and her head's bouncing around, you know, her hair is kind of flipping, and she's turning this way, and she's turning that way, and she's just being a young kid. And then they cut to another camera that was straight on, and as the Pope was finishing up getting the gift from the young boy, the girl turned to someone that she knew in the audience and was just smiling from ear to ear. She was so excited to be up there. And at that moment, the Pope turned back to her and extended his hand to shake her hand, and she didn't even see it. Here is the leader of a billion Catholics worldwide. Here is the man who sits in the Vicar of Christ's seat, an unbroken line of popes for almost 2,000 years, extending his hand, I kid you not, for about 4 or 5 seconds, waiting there. And I just thought, this is classic. This is classic. Leave it to a child not to understand or respect boxes at all. It didn't matter to her. She was more excited about whoever it was that she was connecting with in the audience than the leader of Catholicism in the free world, in the entire world. And just as he was about to give up and pull his hand back, she turned and saw him and she grabbed his hand, and so they did connect. But it was another amazing moment. It was all about these boxes. You know, the ones that we think are so important, that kids see right through and they're invisible to them, you know? What are we supposed to think about what it is that we're doing here? And what is it that defines us? What is it that we identify with in terms of the boxes that we have? And that's kind of where my thoughts were going all this week. What are the boxes that I identify with so strongly that blind me to the people that might sit in a different box? And what are the commonalities that I can connect with them? You know, maybe it's not a common language that we grew up with, but there's always something. Years ago, when I grew up Catholic, I was baptized as an infant, as we do in the Catholic Church, and I went through 12 years of Catholic school. When I graduated from high school, I decided to actually join the religious order that taught me in high school because they had done so many wonderful things for me. I wanted to be able to do that. So I joined the monastic order and went to the house of formation that they had in Chicago. And it sat outside of a college campus out in the cornfield near Joliet, Illinois. And so I was out there. And as I look back on it now, I realize that I in no way identified with that order. I in no way identified with the brothers that I was supposed to be working with and living with and eventually saying vows for and with. And in the first year, we were called postulants. We didn't take the habit. We didn't take any vows. The vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience were understood, that we were going to be taking those, and we had to live as if. But we didn't take those vows yet. So as I look back and I think about that time in the monastery, I realized that what I really identified with was being sort of this exotic California dude. Because this was back in the 70s when California still held a lot of cachet, especially in the Midwest. And I had lived on the beach. My hair was long and kind of bleached out. I lived in Hawaiian shirts and jeans and shorts. And I showed up to this place with all of these what seemed to me sort of uptight Midwestern types. And I was the exotic one. And I liked that feeling. I liked feeling that I was the one who was different, who was special somehow. And I had never experienced a winter, but I'll tell you what, I wore that Hawaiian shirt into classes walking a couple of miles well after snow was falling. And I was freezing, but that was kind of my badge of honor. That was what I was identifying with, even more than the order itself. And what the order was trying to teach us was how to live in community. You know, the vows of chastity and poverty, they were kind of out there. We didn't have to deal with those. Obedience was the big one. How do you learn to live in community? A bunch of 17 and 18-year-old kids along with 60 and 70-year-old brothers in a single house. How does that happen? Well, it happens with rules. It happens with discipline. It happens with setting boundaries that are respected. And I wouldn't respect any of those boundaries. I was the rebel without a cause. I was the one who was always pushing the envelope. I was the one who didn't get it, didn't understand what was supposed to be happening. And what was supposed to be happening was a learning to identify with the group, to learn to live together. And finally, when things came to a head and the novice master had completely had it with me, he happened to be an ex-wrestling coach, so he let me have it pretty good physically. But he got me into his office and he said, "You know what? I can't let you win, because if you win, I lose all these other guys." Oh, I got it. I understood what was going on. I understood the reason for the rules that didn't make any sense. I started to understand that this was something that I needed to participate in, to start to identify with. And as soon as I did that, I realized I was in the wrong place. And I left before the year was out. But it was a huge lesson for me. And I didn't learn it right away. And in fact, as I went through my 20s and when I left the monastery, I sort of left the Catholic Church. And 15 years later, my life was in the toilet. It was just a mess by then. I found myself divorced. I found myself in places that I never thought I would be. And I realized desperately that I needed to be a part of something that was larger than myself. I had spent almost 15 years out of any groups except my own. And look where it had gotten me. And I wanted so bad, so desperately to be a part of a group. I tried a lot of different churches and I tried a lot of different things. And when I finally landed in an evangelical Christian church for the first time, it felt sort of like home because it was Christianity, but it felt really different at the same time. And I just wanted to be on the inside. And I was willing pretty much to do anything to be a part of that group. I wanted it so badly. And the safety and the sense of security of being in that group. But because they were so conservative, the beliefs that they held sort of immediately kicked me right back out of the nest. And I had to figure out, okay, if this is Christianity, then I don't know if I can be a Christian. You know, or maybe it's just this church, but I had to figure it out. And that started me on a whole new cycle and quest in my life to try to find out, what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? What group am I supposed to identify with? Just a little while ago, maybe about a year ago, I got a really angry email from a man in Minnesota. And he was taking me to task about things that were published on our website, the Effect website. And he was going up and down. And I emailed back to him and I said, "You know, I'll answer all your questions, but what's going on here? You know, what's actually happening? Why are you asking me these questions and why are you angry?" And he emailed back to me that he had a 17-year-old son. And he was a staunch Christian, a leader in his church. And suddenly his son was showing signs of rebellion and really, you know, butting heads about their belief system and this and that. And finally, his son asked him a classic question. He said, "Dad, I need to know if what you believe is true or if it's just what you believe." Wow. What a question. And when his dad pressed him further about what it is that he was learning and what, where was he coming from, he gave him our website address. Yeah, so that's why he was kind of on me. But you know what? We ended up being able to talk through it, this father and I from Minnesota, and we got to a place where we understood each other, and he calmed down. But that question remains. Is what we believe true, or is it just what we believe? Have we been put into a box? Did we put ourselves into a box that became comfortable, that became home, that became security, but may have nothing to do with our ultimate meaning and purpose here? What do we identify with? What is it that we're really after in life? You know, what is going on? And this is something that I desperately needed to know. I reconnected with Catholics at Sarah Retreat in Malibu, and the two priests especially became very close to me, and I started working with them and talking to them and bouncing things off of them. And one of them, Emery Tang, as we were fighting about some theological deal, and I think it was that he said that the devil was really a metaphor or something like that, so all my evangelical hairs stood up on end. How can you say that? This is what the Bible says. And he just kind of put that big hand out, and he said, you know, just stop for a minute. He says, all I can tell you is what I've become convinced of. You go become convinced of what you are convinced of. And at the time I thought it was a cop-out. Now I realize it's the only possible answer that any one of us can give to another. This is what I'm convinced of. This is where my journey has led me. Now, Father Tang was always in trouble because of saying things like that, and always in trouble because of his views that he would teach at this retreat center. And people were always sending letters to the chancery office and trying to get him defrocked and try to get him out of his position. And yet, he remained a Catholic. He remained a priest. He was in his 60s at the time, and you knew he was never going to leave the church. He was never going to leave being a priest. These were the things that animated him. These were things that defined him. And yet, he had found a way to transcend a priest, to transcend Catholicism. In some cases, to even transcend the box of Christianity in which he sat, and to swim in a deeper ocean, a deeper sea. He had found a way to do both at the same time. You know, I think the only thing sadder than being so identified with the box, so identified with the group that you can't see another, is having no identification with any group at all. We need that as humans. We need to be connected in some way. But at the same time, we need to learn to transcend that. How in the world does that happen? How in the world do we get to the point where we can see the connection with our group, that we can have total integrity with the belief system that we have, with the rules or whatever the disciplines are with the group, but still see beyond that as well? And I think what that comes down to, pure and simple, is desire. What is it that you desire? Do you desire truth? Or do you desire the group and the box and the security that that provides? And this is where I turn to Jesus. What is it that Jesus said? Did Jesus say anything about this subject? And yes, he did. Absolutely. And if you look at, if you have your lyric sheets down at the bottom there, Matthew 6:24 is a classic verse that I think can get us into the ballpark here. Jesus said, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." Now, here's the important thing. The word there that is translated wealth in the actual Greek of the New Testament is not translated from the Aramaic at all. Jesus probably spoke Aramaic. Most scholars think so. When you look at the original word that was used, most often it's translated as mammon. But the word in Aramaic is mamona. And if you look at the roots of mamona, although yes, it can mean wealth and riches and all of that, you know what it really means? It really means to have confidence in, to have trust in. How in the world do you get from confidence and trust to wealth and riches? Think about that for just a moment. Because the things that we pile up in our lives, the things that we learn to trust and have security in our lives, are the things that come to define us in our lives. And this is the connection that the ancients saw between what we had confidence in, what we trusted, what we took security in, and those things that we piled up in our lives that then came to define us. And Jesus is saying very clearly here, you can't serve God and the stuff that you pile up in your life that gives you a sense of security, the stuff that begins to define you. You can't do it because you're always going to come down on one side or the other. You're going to hate the one, you're going to love the other, you're going to be devoted to one, you're going to despise the other. If there isn't a sense of desire in us that wants so badly to connect with the living God that can move us past all of these things, these boxes in our lives, then we're going to get stuck. And that's what Jesus is trying to tell us here. You know, it's an amazing thing if you think about it. How do you even know? How do you know what defines you in your life? Have you ever thought about that? What is the thing that you identify with most? What is the thing that defines you the most? You know, the clearest example that I can give you is of an alcoholic. An alcoholic who doesn't yet know or is not willing to admit that he or she is an alcoholic will say, well, I don't drink every day. You know, I can go weeks sometimes without drinking. And I have this pattern, or I have that pattern, or whatever. But if a person is spending a lot of their time, maybe all of their time, thinking about the next drink, thinking about how they're going to get it, how they're going to pay for it, how they're going to hide it, how they're going to do this or how they're going to do that, when all of their time and energy is wrapped around the procurement and the consumption of alcohol or any substance, they are now defined by that substance. And it's the same thing with anything that's in our lives. Think about it. What is it that you spend the most time thinking about, worrying about, trying to procure in your life? Those are the things that define you. Jesus said, if you abide in my word, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free, set you free. Free from what? Free from thinking and worrying and planning and stressing. True freedom is always freedom from something. From what? From the anxiety of the worry, from the bondage, from the enslavement of the things that we have allowed to define us. Whatever those are the things that we can transcend when our desire is for God and for the truth. In this second phrase from Luke 14, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, okay, what in the world is he talking about now? If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. What is Jesus talking about? The first thing we need to know is that the word translated as hate there in Aramaic, sana, doesn't mean hate in a malicious way, in a harmful way, the way we think of hate. What it means is simply to prefer less. Okay? What is Jesus saying? Jesus is saying, if you cannot work past every box, every role, every relationship that exists in your life, if you cannot work past that, you can't follow me. If your basic definition in life is as mother, as father, as wife, as sister, as brother, as Democrat, as Republican, if that is what defines you, if that's what borders and limits your life, and you cannot move past that, how in the world can you follow Jesus? Because when Jesus called his disciples, what did the scripture tell us? They left everything and followed him. They dropped their nets if they defined themselves as fishermen. They walked away from their tax collecting booths and stands if that's what defined them. They walked away from whatever it was in order to find something new, something different, something transcendent. When Jesus says, if you want to find your life, you need to lose it. When the scriptures tell us and talk to us about dying to ourselves, this is exactly what's going on here. Whatever it is, the picture in our mind that we have of ourselves and who we are and what we are, if we aren't willing to just ruthlessly let that go and to find out who we are directly in relationship to our God, then we can't transcend our boxes. And our boxes within boxes will securely hold us like the prison that they are. One of the most influential writers, another Catholic, when I was going through most of this transformation that I was going through 10, 15 years ago, was Thomas Merton. And at the end of his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, he is just about to take his final vows as a monk, and he is just about to enter the hermitage, where he will leave even the community of his fellow monks and go into complete solitude. And this has required him to ruthlessly, as we just said, strip away everything that he thought he was. I want to read you just the paragraph from the last page of his autobiography and listen to the imagery and the language that he uses. He says, "Everything that touches you shall burn you, and you will draw your hand away in pain until you have withdrawn yourself from all things. Everything that can be desired will sear you and brand you with a cautery, and you will fly from it in pain to be alone. Every created joy will only come to you as pain, and you will die to all joy and be left alone. All the good things that other people love and desire and seek will come to you, but only as murderers to cut you off from the world and its preoccupations, that you may become the brother of God and learn to know the Christ of the burnt men." When I read that the first time, it just stopped me in my tracks. I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. But what I did know is that he had had an experience that caused him to write this particular passage with these particular images, violent images, hard images. Because I'll tell you what, the old self, the person that we have come to rely on and have confidence in, does not die easy, does not die quietly. It'll go kicking and screaming from our lives. And it's going to be a difficult process. But here's a note of encouragement. It's not change that is painful. It's resistance to change that is painful. And we can flow with this in a beautiful way. We don't have to write this kind of language. We don't have to feel this kind of pain necessarily. But it will be a stripping away of everything that is familiar and everything that we have come to know and have confidence in, so that we can have confidence in He who is the true sustainer of our lives. And that's the key. Rabbi Schneier, when he was finishing his talk, he said something that I want to leave us with this morning. He said, "Our love for God must never come at the expense of our love for God's children. Our love for God must never come at the expense of our love for God's children." What does that mean? It means we need to love God more than we love our boxes. We need to identify more with the Spirit of God than we identify with the groups that we find ourselves, so that we can learn, like God, to love everyone equally, to connect with everyone equally, and to transcend the limited people that we will be otherwise. Desire. Do you desire that more than anything? Then it can be yours. You can leave everything at the shore and follow. Let's pray. Father, as we prepare to do our baptisms this morning. And baptisms are the very symbol of this transformation. The very symbol, going into the water, symbolizing going into the tomb, symbolizing death itself, and to come up again, full immersion, as new creatures, as new creations, starting completely over again. That symbolism, that process that we're going to go through in just a few moments, Lord, help us to see that that is the process of each of our lives. And it doesn't just happen once. It doesn't just happen at baptism. It happens every single day, that we are willing to see beyond the edge of our boxes, to see that there is another there out there that you provide for us, that you are calling us to. Thank you, Father, for just the outpouring of gifts and love that you give us constantly. Help us to see beyond our self-imposed limitations, to see what you have for us next, in this moment and the next moment and the moment after that. Give us the courage to be able to let go of those things that we are hanging on to, the security blankets in our lives that are now just weighing us down, Help us to have that courage. Help us to see in you there is no risk. In you there is no lack of love and provision. And we thank you for everything that you do for us, Lord, every single moment. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Let's stand, and for those of you who are new with us, we recite the Our Father as a last thing together.